So here we are in another episode of In a Perfect World, and I have a very special guest here today. You know, it's very interesting because I've been doing this show for about 5 years now, and I think I can count on one hand the number of empowered psychedelic or shamanic women that I have interviewed, not through any fault of my own, but just through, I guess, that this has been a very a male-dominated field in many ways, and I'm very pleased today to be talking with Mariana Dinkova.
Hey, Rick.
How are you going? I hope I pronounced your name right.
Yeah, pleasure to be in the show. It's an honor.
Yeah, so Mariana, I first met you in Santa Cruz earlier this year in 2014 when the Aya film was touring around, and it was great to see someone who's also in the shamanic community and also a woman, but also doing such dynamic work. You're doing work both with taking some tour groups over to Peru and dealing with the issues around that and empowering people with that. But you also work as a psychotherapist and a life coach in San Francisco, and you've done a few workshops both with David J. Brown and on your own around the issues of navigating altered states.
Yes, that has been definitely one of the topics that I am super passionate about and have been passionate about for many, many, many years. So it feels really good to finally be bringing some of the tools that I've been collecting for some of them for 20 years and creating like a coherent body of work to introduce it to people. And I've been really enjoying combining some of the tools for navigating altered states, which were a lot of them were developed for navigating ayahuasca specifically, although they can work for all kinds of altered states from PMS to ecstatic states in general and breath work, but a lot of them are also extremely applicable for the ayahuasca experience. So I have been really, really happy that in the last year I have been able to bring them to, in Peru the first time, to the 9th Amazonian Peruvian Shanga Conference. I was able to co-teach the workshops there for people who were going to do journey work that night and got some amazing feedback, which inspired me to start doing retreats in which I bring people to Peru to some very experienced shamans, and I teach the tools and I bring a framework, and the shamans do the medicine work. And I have gotten some really amazing feedback about how the combination of psychotherapy tools, new shamanistic navigation tools, and medicine work has been a really accelerated field of transformation, and people have gotten a lot of healing out of it.
Yeah, beautiful. I guess it's a really potent field, you know, like a lot of Westerners are experiencing ayahuasca all around the world and in South America, and quite often I guess people, you know, you can prepare for it, you can read up about it, and then you go through the experience, and even if they're prepared on some psychological level, there's the peeling back and there's the revelation of whatever ayahuasca's working on with the person. But a lot of people still don't have very fundamental, I guess, mental skills to navigate their own consciousness even when they're not on ayahuasca. So I guess, you know, using some of your skill base from psychotherapy and working to help people know themselves would be a very valuable overlap with the West as it moves into ayahuasca and altered states.
Yeah, my master's is in somatics, and one of my favorite psychotherapy training, actually two of them, one was in Hakami. Hakami is body and experience-centered psychotherapy, and the other one was RCS, which is recreation of the self. And those two have some tools, for example, which are amazing when used under the influence, for example, in an ayahuasca experience. And they're amazing when they're used in mindfulness in a normal session. But also in some of those places, I have found tools that are providing amazing shortcuts to healing, and people can really use and have them experience the benefits in ways that even over 2 months of patients. And on the other hand, I would not agree that people are very prepared for journeys. I know that the very first journey I went to was the very first time the shaman said, and the only time the shaman said something as important as, and by the way, you might die, and if you die, it's normal. You will come back in the morning. Nobody has ever died. But relax and smell the flowers, so to say. Take the experience in, let yourself have the experience, don't freak out, you will be back.
Well, that it sort of hits it right on the head, is it? In much of Western culture, we're mollycoddled and we're kept away from this idea of death, you know, where the whole consumer culture is to create a somatic or comfort buffer zone between us and the realities of life and death and the more cosmic universe. And so, yeah, I mean, for a shaman to say you might die, it's very appropriate because we're not used to that, are we?
Absolutely, and I did die that night, actually. It was the most beautiful experience, one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had, which did take my fear of death to a very big degree. But since then, I have watched so many people, and some of them my friends, some of them other people, who spent most of their night journeying in ayahuasca ceremony fighting the death experience because they don't know it's normal, although it is called the vine of the death. They don't know they will come back, and instead of being able to really have the experience and let themselves take it in and take notes and really experience it, they spend a lot of their energy fighting it because they're really afraid they're going to die. And very little information is being told. I have drunk maybe with 20 plus shamans at least, and different cultures of different backgrounds in different countries. And only one of them said that you can die, and probably one of the longest explanations about the experience I've heard from one of them was, you might have some visions and you might experience some emotions. End of explanation. So I know I've been feeling this almost urgency for many, many years about, hey, there's so much you can do in there. How comes nobody's talking about it? So I developed a lot of my system of how to... on one side, there are tools how to deal with difficult situations, tools how to interact with the space once you get in there, how to ask for answers, how to resource yourself. I can tell you much more about my tools if you want to. But I have a pretty interesting collection that is pretty eclectic. And on the other hand, letting people have a little bit of a map of the territory.
Well, interesting. We'll get into the tools because I think that is the juicy bit that people want to hear about some of what these tools are. But it's just interesting when you were saying that, I was realizing that all the 20 different shamans you've drunk with, and you know a couple of them have said important strategic things. But it was reminding me in a sense that it's interesting because you're coming from a Western psychotherapist background, and the shamans are basically an indigenous jungle psychotherapy, you know, like in their culture, they're fulfilling one part of their role is sort of fulfilling what in the West and the psychotherapy does. And I guess it just shows, you know, you've got to shop around and you can go to different practitioners to find the one that fits you or the one that is going to be the best fit for you.
True. And also apart from shopping around, and it's interesting that you mentioned the cultural background, because that is been one of the things that I help people work with, is finding out their own little personal mythology and working with their own archetypes.
Oh.
I remember sitting many years ago in a tipi where the shaman was calling the spirit of the bear. I was like, okay, I've seen a bear in a zoo, I can roll with that. Then he called this the coyote, and I was like, what does a coyote look like, and how is this thing going to ever protect me if I have zero relationship with it?
Yeah.
So you kept calling in animals that I have maximum seen in a zoo. Okay, yes, I've seen an eagle in the sky once, but I don't feel protected by them. I don't feel like this. So in some ways, in some part of my workshops, I help people identify what are some archetypes that they really feel protected by or supported by, or... it can be also something like Spider-Man or...
That's so funny you say that. I was just having a flashback to my own raver days and remembering that I sort of spontaneously did this with cartoon archetypes. It's like, because, you know, for a lot of people in the West, we might not grow up outside in nature if we live in cities, but we've grown up in a media-saturated environment and the archetypes sink into our subconscious.
Yeah, and a lot of us would feel much more protected by Gandalf or Yoda than by the spirit of the coyote.
That's brilliant. Because, you know, it's interesting because so many people say, oh, what is it about the jaguar and the boa? And, you know, each of the animals does have a, you know, symbolic representation either to the psyche or to different elements or to different sort of strengths and attributes. And there's all reason to it. But you're right, if we don't resonate with these jungle archetypes, I guess they're still on the astral landscape. They might still be in there. We might still encounter them. But we can also, as you say, sort of retrofit and draw upon our own archetypal base.
Exactly. And then rely much
funky,
more...
like Spider-Man in ayahuasca space.
Absolutely. I mean, there is value to the shamans calling them in. I remember like drinking in Brazil one time with Carioca for a 2-week retreat, and they were calling in Iemanjá, and they were calling in Oshun. And I want to trust that the shamans who can create big enough strong protector grid for the group so they can call their own archetypes that they're really close to. But honestly, that was the first time I had heard about Iemanjá or Oshun, so they were not doing it for me. And how to also help people find archetypes that, or they can be their grandma, it can be their dead grandma or alive grandma, it can be their father if they need to. So some of it can be from cultural back stories, other ones can be from actual real life. And it's been beautiful to watch at least one person who had, there are two people who came from the Temple of the Way of Light, and one of them had had always almost negative experiences in ayahuasca. And to be able to restructure how they see ayahuasca in general, because how people see the medicine influences a lot of the experience. And in his case, he was seeing her as this punitive force that was going to make him pay for his sins. And after doing the workshop with me, his archetype was Bruce Lee. So when kind of the darker forces came, A, he reminded himself that she's a healer versus a dominatrix in some ways, and then called in Bruce Lee and had his first amazingly beautiful experience in his life, where he was actually able to tap into the healing power of ayahuasca, and that was really beautiful to watch. Yay for Bruce Lee.
Oh, yeah, I love Bruce Lee. I used to have a Bruce Lee outfit, the yellow one, you know, with the black stripe down the side. Yeah, been there. Mm-hmm. Done that, yeah. Actually, it's interesting because I guess some people, you know, the purists might say, look, yet again, you know, Westerners are going down to Peru, we're drinking indigenous medicine, where, you know, we're commodifying or absorbing the bits we want. And they, even on the inner astral landscapes now, we're colonizing it with our archetypes. But I mean, this is natural and this is what we do. And as you say, if it works for people and helps re-engineer their relationship with the medicine and with themselves, then it is a valuable tool.
And we are living in the era of information cross-pollination. They're watching our TV, too. I mean, they're watching their own TV and they're watching our movies, so they're definitely cross-pollinating archetypes for a while now.
Yeah.
So as much as I have a lot of respect of indigenous cultures, there is also a place for cross-pollination.
Okay. So this is really interesting. I'm getting a lot out of this so far, but I just want to backtrack a bit. Maybe you'll get into, you know, where you're coming from. You work in San Francisco and you're a psychotherapist and a life coach. Mm-hmm. Maybe tell us a bit about what you do in that type of role and how those skills then apply to what you're doing in the shamanic field.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the funny thing is that I switched when I was 19 from architecture to psychology after reading the book LSD and Psychotherapy from Stanislav Grof. So in a way, that already changed my life, the idea that psychotherapy can be super effective or catalyzed under certain states. And at that time, I thought that I would be actually working with outer states when I grow up, so to say. Now I'm not working with outer states. I'm the person before and after. Although the majority of my practice is individual clients who work on a variety of issues or also some couples. So the majority of my practice are people who come for normal psychotherapy or relationship coaching, and with quite a big part of my clients also who do medicine work. I help a lot with the before and after. So I help with the preparation, with the intention setting, and then we work a lot on integration.
Mm.
Some of my clients came from some talks and workshops I did in the city on navigating altered states and on sharing different techniques. So some of my clients came from the medicine work community, and I have been able to do amazing work with people who have had those experiences and have had deep experiences of being one with the universe, deep experiences of self-love, or one of those deep experiences that ayahuasca or altered states can give you, because we can use those things as a resource in the psychotherapy session.
Well, that's because so good. I mean, integration is one of the key themes and issues that is facing the global shamanic community I see at the moment, and it's very interesting. That's great to know that, you know, you are doing that, and potentially, who knows, maybe there's some other people out there doing that, because we do need more practitioners to help with that integration. And as you say, you know, it's like, you know, I am one with the universe one day, and then it's like, well, what do you do the next day? You know,
I remember actually the first time I used that was in a hardcore PMS day in which I hated the universe. I was feeling small and vindictive and I wanted to scratch somebody's eyes out. And there was this little voice in the back of my mind going, come on, Mariana, you've been so big, so Buddha-like, and we're going to do what? And calling in one of my selves. Past selves. I mean, I sometimes work with past self and future selves. And this time I called in one Mariana from one of my very first ayahuasca ceremonies, who was one with the universe and had this huge knowledge of the human condition and a huge compassion for how limited we can be in this realm. And it took me about, less than 10 minutes, but I constricted some exercises that I'm also teaching in the integration part. But it was amazing how I went from this little screeching, like, I hate the world and I'm so PMS and want to strangle this little fluffy animal state to a beautiful, open, expansive, ecstatic state through calling in that Mariana, who had done journey work and had knowledge that was in a big, much larger context that I could hold in my little PMS brain. And it worked. She pulled me out.
Maybe without giving away your trade secrets, but how exactly do you do that? Is that like the NLP sort of work with anchoring and going back, or regression therapy or stuff like that?
Some of it is somatic and some of it is, I mean, in that particular case, I imagined her behind me and I asked her to do the work because it was from my limited state. There was almost a voice going, I don't want to change. Like, don't make me change. But in a very low frequency thing. And I mean, sometimes I work with also creating, almost finding the center of one state. So I found my own center and found her center. I put her behind me as a visualization and asked her to pull me in. Because the energy of the space I was holding in my kind of more upset state was very low. And I wanted her to kind of take over. So in some ways, in that particular one, I envisioned the thread between our centers and how one of the other tools I teach came from hypnosis, which is a hypnotic command that in the next few 2 minutes, I don't know how, but those two centers are going to become one. So when you give the command at end time and you put it under time pressure, sometimes, and you don't have to know the how, you don't need to know how that's going to happen, which is partially similar to some of the techniques of manifestation or of hypnosis, but all I knew was that in the next few minutes, I was sitting up straight and my heart opened and I was full of bliss. So she did the job.
Right. So basically we can reprogram our unconscious mind to, you know, do the bidding of our conscious mind.
Yeah. And I love actually using some of that terminology, like reprogramming or even hacking.
Yeah.
Because some of those tools are made to reprogram or to create shortcuts.
Wow. All right, well, let's get into your toolbox then. So what are some of your skills or the tools that you do teach for navigating altered states?
Some of them are what I mentioned with creating your own support team. So it can be creating places. It can be, again, archetypes or places where you feel safe. Or having some of them are about interacting with the space, and often going deep in ayahuasca can be like going into something like the matrix, and you can create good magic and bad magic there, and you can, and I know how many people come in there with the negative programming, and I have worked with a lot of clients around that.
What do you call negative programming?
If you go in there and you start going, I can't do this, I can't do this, ooh, this is so hard, I can't do this, you're reinforcing something. Or sometimes you go in there and go like, why is it that I'm so fucked up? Why is it that I cannot love? Why is it that I'm so defective? So there is also ways that you can either make questions or statements in there that reinforce a very, very limited reality that sees you as broken or defective, or reality as broken and defective. And it's a little bit like what you put out is what you reinforce. And on the other side, how can I open my heart is a very different question in that space than why is it that I cannot love?
Mm.
And it opens a whole different not experience. The question, how is it that I can be with that experience in a way that is comfortable, is very different from the statement, I can't do this, this is too hard. You're giving completely different messages to the space, to your nervous system, and you're getting different results.
Do you find, though, that this type of work is best done, as you say, as preparatory stuff before people go in ceremony?
I think it's really important to do before people go in ceremony. So to say that the people have some kind of a toolkit. And in my workshops, like in the longer retreats, we actually get to exercise. And we do exercises how to not only understand the exercises, but know how to use them. So it's good to have a little bit of a time to have your toolkit. And there are many other tools I can talk about, but also to remember to use them. Because it's a little bit like the dialectics between, yes, you have to fully surrender to the experience, and yes, you can do some navigating to optimize it.
You're right. That was I've heard that from people that have a friend who was actually in Peru around the time you were doing your workshops, and his feedback was he thought that it would be difficult to basically apply some of the techniques during the surrender of ayahuasca and letting it do the work it needs to do. But I can see both sides.
Yeah, if it's not broken, don't fix it. If she's doing the work and it feels all good, don't interfere. Yeah. On the other hand, sometimes I know that some experience can feel barely bearable. And I remember like one of the first times, for example, I drank a brew that was meant to be the strongest brew ever. And usually I'm very happy in ayahuasca if I go into one immersive other parallel universe. And this one was, she was like, oh yeah, is that what you want? What about 170 at once? I remember going into, so I can freak out and get overwhelmed right now. Or, and thanks God, somehow I had the peace of mind to ask ayahuasca, how do I navigate so many parallel universes at the same time? Great question, and she gave me the answer straight away. I was able to, it was like almost a somatical sense, which I was able to integrate, and then it was easy. Then it was, okay, that's how you do it, thank you.
It sounds like you have a very feisty relationship, either with ayahuasca or with your subconscious.
I wouldn't say feisty. I think that was supportive. She was there straight away when I asked her.
I think there can be support in feisty. I'm trying to get the right word for it. You know, dynamic is a word, but it's not as dynamic. I just knowing a bit of your personality, I think that you know that would come out in that space and how you interact with that space.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes even the question would be, "Can you help me surrender more?"
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yay for surrender. It is one of the biggest tools ever. And sometimes people find themselves also fighting it or resisting the space. So,
what's your best advice on surrender?
You can...
I mean, because, you get into ceremony, you're like, all right, Madre, I'm here, I'm present, I'm fully willing, I'm listening, I'm able. I surrender. And you say it mentally in your head. You believe it. The ego believes that it is saying to the Madre, I surrender. And then nothing happens.
You can say, show me how to surrender, for example. And I remember actually one ceremony where the brew was not very strong, at least it felt like to me. So when I was just surrendering, going, okay, do it to me, it was not much happening. But when I got like, hey, how can we do it? She went like, hey, you have to meet me halfway. You have to come to me halfway and then I'll come to you. So when I actually really... almost I had to focus on my experience and the places she was touching me and put more of my, not just wait for her to come and do me, so to say, but yeah. Meet her halfway and really do half of the work to interact with her. Then she opened up and then it was easy to surrender because it was a much bigger space. Then she really gave me the experience that I can surrender to versus just like trying to get in there.
Yeah. Well, I guess what you're saying and what other people, commentators have said as well, it's you have a relationship with ayahuasca and it's not just that she's doing this thing to you. You have to give permission. You have to open to it. You have to ask for help. You have to, you know, so it is about relationship building, isn't it?
It is.
And this is interesting because you're a relationship counselor, you know, a psychotherapist, life coach, relationship counselor. So I find this very interesting, the ways that what happens to a relationship counselor when she's on ayahuasca?
Builds relationship with ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's true. I mean, in some ways we have relationship with our neurosis, we have relationship with our strengths, we have relationship with our inner critic, we have relationships with a lot of part of us. And ayahuasca, it can be sometimes, one of the cute nicknames I heard about her is that she's a psychotherapy on steroids. So that was my joke with putting the psychotherapy techniques in the ayahuasca context, really brings out the psychotherapy and steroids. But on the other hand, we are these huge relational beings. And we have relationship to God, we have relationship to universe, to the universe, we have relationship to our body, we have relationships to our emotions. And in some of my workshops specifically, the work on relationships is not only the relationships with the outside. I mean, it's huge, the relationship with the self, and I have a lot of tools in the workshops that help people become aware of what is their relationship to the self and how ayahuasca can help, because once you give her more specific directions and context, then she can really come in and do her magic. Then the other part is relationships with other people, and she can be an amazing healer when it comes to healing family ties and also forgiving other people. I've had some personal experiences, but also in my workshops, people have had groundbreaking experiences of healing past relationships, forgiving themselves, forgiving family members, forgiving. And forgiveness is huge. And I mean, I have some personal experience I don't need to share now, but ayahuasca showing me how the forgiving works and going in there and doing almost like heart surgery around emotions, so she can be amazing that way. And some of it is relationship to our own programming. Like, I know one of my clients, for example, who was doing with a lot of self-hate, she was showing him how the part of him that is generating self-hate is not him. And he switched it off for a while and showing him, like, do you see this thing? That's that software program that is generating self-hate that you have, but it's not you, and it's off right now. It might be on sometime in the future, but that's what it looks like. So relationship is this multi-complex web of things that we can have towards ourselves, towards God and the divine, and towards other people. And ayahuasca can be amazing around that.
Interesting. So you mentioned God a few times now. How do you reconcile or define your cosmology, being, you know, a Western psychotherapeutic practitioner, and then also being a person who has... You know, you mentioned Stan Grof as well, and coming from a transpersonal psychotherapy and that psychedelic lineage, and now the shamanic cosmology as well. How do you define all of those different worlds? How do they sit with you?
Funny enough, I mean, I have been into meditation and studying with different masters since I was a teenager. And by the first time I drank ayahuasca, somewhere in my early 20s, I had been already reading all the Seth books, the Jane Goddard's channel of materials, and I had gone to Pune, and I had sat with masters, and I knew a lot about meditation and all the spiritual concepts, but it was ayahuasca who broke it down to me and showed me how they really work. Kind of a thing. I remember her saying, that thing they say about being in the moment, it works like this. You take the moment and you become so present to it. And she showed me how to do it. And this thing opened up and it became like a multi-dimensional highway. And I was like, oh, wow, that's what they mean, that in the moment, being in the moment is the key to all the different worlds. And then her explaining me the nature of space-time, her explaining me the nature of consciousness of meditation. So in some ways, my inner cosmology is deeply influenced by the guidance of ayahuasca, where she used all the knowledge I already had, but she showed me how it works.
Wow. Okay, that sounds really good. Well, just give us a bit more overview of your toolbox. You've mentioned quite a few different sort of things, but what are some of the key techniques or the key things that you would teach people? Like, what and why would you teach them these things? I mean, what are the contexts that they can use them in?
I know that a lot of people hear ayahuasca partially, for example, because of their ability to sometimes to have hard experiences. So having some kind of tools to deal with hard experiences with would take a lot of people's resistance around ayahuasca. And I know that I have worked with people where that has worked. Also being able to use her a little bit more for certain goals and working in certain intentions. I know that in the last two retreats I did, especially in the second one, people were amazed how accurate she responded to their intentions. So being able to get support to craft specific intentions in a positive manner before each ceremony made a huge impact in the experience. Like, in my joke is that usually I put my intentions, she takes me in, she shows me the multiverse and takes me all over the inner and outer cosmos, and at the end of it, when we're almost done, she's like, ah, oh, yeah, that thing with your intentions, here it is. but also how it makes a big difference to prepare in that sense, and also especially how to do them in a positive way. I know that, so that's one of the tools, is how to talk in a way that you create what you want, not what you don't want. I remember one of my trainers in Hakomi, I think many years ago, was using that metaphor that the unconscious is like a dog. If you tell it, go fetch that part of me that is broken and you would never be saved, it's going to go and find it. If you tell it, go fetch that part of me that is divine and it can never be broken, it was going to go and find it. So how you give commands and how you focus your search engine in there, so to say, and how do you speak with the space, it makes huge difference in the results one can get.
That's so true. I once called ayahuasca's like Google for the vegetal internet. And I think you're right. If you do the right search results, what you type in is what you're going to get back, or the available pool of responses you'll get back.
Yeah, and a lot of people are so fear-driven, so they type in things they don't want to find out. I mean, it's not where, whatever you feed, it grows. Whatever you give more consciousness to, it grows. And a lot of people are wired around fear and resentment, so that's what can grow. And, I mean, ayahuasca is wiser than that. Mm. And that's partially, there is a deeper wisdom in the plants that I have so much reverence for. And I know that at least one client who was having a really hard time with themselves, was borderline, like in a really hard space, who went one time in a ceremony and went like, okay, drag me to hell and kill me. And she kind of showed him through the whole journey all the cycles in life and death, and how death is a normal part of the cycle, and at the end of it, how precious and lovable he was. So it's not that they're putting the wrong thing in the Google search, you necessarily are going to get the bad results, because she does have a bigger intelligence than that. But it's still like you can make shortcuts, and a lot of people have no idea how to utilize the ability to craft spells into those spaces. I mean, I call it spells, but it's pretty much like how to interact with the space in a way that really gives them the results they want.
That's what I wanted. Like, say someone is putting in the right search quest, for their results, and they're clear and they're not in fear, and they are tumbling through infinite kaleidoscopic matrix universes. How do you know which way is up? Like, do you have tools to help them? I mean, these are the deep shamanic resources, really. This is what the curanderos learn to navigate hyperspace, and it takes them a long time. So what Western knowledge can we bring to this? To, I guess, it's more almost traditionally seen as more of a psychedelic space, and even talking about Stan Grof and some of the transpersonal psychology, and how to really navigate. Say you're emotionally clear and you're okay, but how do we know which way is up? It's almost like a virtual reality thing. It's like you want to know which way is up, you want to be moving forward, you want to be, being able to fully navigate in that realm.
Which way is up is an interesting metaphor. And just to be clear, I would recommend for most people to drink also with an experienced curandero. Ideally, you want to have the combination of somebody who can hold the space outside, who has a lot of experience and has spent many years doing the work themselves, and have the tools yourself. So I'm all about working with the outer shaman while empowering the inner shaman. And let's say if everything is going well, you can always, one of my favorite tools is asking for the part of you that already knows. Mm. So if you ask for, I want to go into the part of me that knows how to optimize this experience. It's almost you put into Google search, what is my highest, most experienced Iman Shaman, log in there.
Clever. Okay.
Sometimes, I mean, there have been also other hacking tricks. If you meet with some people meet snakes, or some people meet deities, some people can meet entities from the god realms in there. And with some of them, you don't want much to do with, unless you do. And there is actually like a short period of meet and greet in which there is also all kinds of magic to be done. But one of the tools with, especially with higher entities, with not only, can be the one that works amazing in ayahuasca sometimes, especially with higher order entities, can be show me what it's like to be you. And that's another hacking trick I use, which is kind of how to merge consciousness with those forces, instead of going me little human fragile while you powerful deity or something. Or sometimes it can be even parts of the self. So some of them are how to relate with certain other forces, other ones are how to hack into them. Because we do have, in those spaces, we do have the ability to work information in a very different way. Then sometimes, if an experience is too much, there are also the transpersonal tools I use, which is if you become the witness or if you go into becoming the screen in which the experience is being projected second by second by second by second, it's much easier to be with it if it's something really intense than if you become the content. So some of the transpersonal tools of becoming the witness or becoming that place where the content meets life energy second by second by second by second can shift immensely your ability to be with a really intense experience.
Yeah.
So you identify with which part, sometimes all by just by shifting identification of which part of yourself you identify with, the whole experience can change.
Speaking of that, I've been in, you know, quite a few ceremonies over the years where someone inevitably will completely lose it, and the bit of their conscious mind which could utilize any of these tools is just completely not able to, you know, languageize or interact with the baseline reality, and they can be lost in that oceanic or some other space they're in. And, you know, the facilitators then have to then try to bring that person back and bring them back to breathing or bring them back to, you know, focusing on a single thing. But it can be really difficult. It can be difficult to snap people out of when they get trapped in, you know, the eddies and currents of these headspaces. How do we help someone, or how does someone help themselves when they're not able to?
And that's the thing, is with very strong doses or with certain experience, there is a window at the beginning where you can use tools and try to steer the ship in the right direction. And once it's over the waterfall, that's why I work with really experienced shamans that I can trust. Because once that person is over the place where they're able to cognitize or respond to the outside world, they're usually not in a place where they can use the tools anymore. The tools can be used, I cannot really tell depending, because different people are in different places. And sometimes I have seen some of the people who seem to have from the outside really hard, really horrible experiences report these beautiful angelic things in the morning.
Yeah.
They're so grateful for and wouldn't want to change a thing about. But also I know that sometimes at the beginning there is a window. It's almost like with negative thinking. I also work with people around cognitive behavioral tools. Like if you have a really bad inner critic or really bad inner paranoid or something, you have 20-something seconds to switch the channels before that thing is in your blood and has influenced all your endocrinal systems. And then you have 15 minutes to switch the channel unless you continue reinforcing it. So I know that sometimes when people lose it, they have been so grateful for whatever experience they had in the morning, and it can be very different what they experienced and what it looks like from the outside.
Yeah.
So I have learned not to make assumptions about where they're at and is it really a bad experience just because it looks scary from the outside. But also, yes, I like working with very experienced shamans who know how to hold space when that happens too. Okay, because as much as I'm the geek and the before and after girl, I love working with people who are really experienced at the curing.
Yeah, oh, it is a gift to work with experienced curanderos you can trust. I guess the question is finding those experienced curanderos you can trust and, you know, having the right space with them to do that. But before we get on to the curanderos and shamans, which we'll talk about in a bit, I just wanted to follow up on your talk of entities. So, you know, you believe in, you're talking some really interesting terminology and words around like sub-programs and programs we have in our own unconscious mind and, you know, programs that are running which can influence us either way. A lot of people in the Western sort of psychotherapy model think that the type of entities we're meeting in altered states are just a projection of our unconscious and there's no external validity or autonomy to them. What do you think about entities?
I do have my own opinion about it and my own experiences about it. I know that, I have encountered different types of entities in my journeys, which it's hard to say what is projection of my imagination versus what is external thing, but I know that they had skill sets and some of them were able to do healings in me that were way beyond my abilities. So a little bit, it's if I made them up, then wow, for the part of me that made it up.
Yeah. So, well, I wonder, because most of the entities, and we sort of have this sort of tangential relationship with them, that we just, you know, appear in their, the spaces at which they are in. We don't really know if they're native to that space that we were inhabiting at that moment, or if they're travelers like we are. And if so, are they navigating altered states as well? And do they have the skill base that we're looking for?
Right. And are they going on vacation in our nervous system, because that's their Club Med?
You have a great turn of phrase. I'm looking forward to your book.
I had a friend who pretty much, that was kind of the deal that the entity was trying to make with, or he was trying to make with the entity, going, okay, I see that what you're after is experiencing the senses in my day. Okay, you can experience my senses if I can experience what it's like to be you. So he kind of tried to make it a trade.
Well, this is interesting, because in normal human relationships, or even, you know, interspecies, like, this is sort of what we do. We do, there's a trade, you know. We get energy from a person or something, but they get something from us as well. So is it any different in the astral or in the, you know, the hyperspatial realm? I guess you've just got to try to strike a good deal.
And you, I mean, the way, that's kind of a quote, David J. Brown, but you treat them the way you treat strangers. Don't trust them just because there is a sense of something is a inner space entity, that that's something smart that has your best interest in mind. And in some of the spaces, kind of this, the protection spells I make are very much about that I invite only forces that have my best interest in mind and know what I need and what it takes and can vibrate in my level.
Yeah.
So almost having like a pre-programmed bubble that only those forces can come in. And sometimes when I have gotten in contact with different forces that felt like really interesting but potentially dark, that's when I have used some of the techniques I was talking about before, like calling Buddha or calling Jesus. And I'm not saying I'm religious, but I'm saying they're archetypes I have some relationship with, that I can hold as big, powerful, and being able to hold a certain frequency, and asking them to be my protectors around those interactions.
Man, I'm calling Spider-Man into my next astral ceremony, and he's going to protect me, let me tell you.
Who's that?
Spider-Man. I'm down with this. I'm empowered by this. That's really interesting. But, you know, I guess this is, there's a self-fulfilling sort of rhythm going on here, where it's like, so, you know, if we put the purple bubble, the hippie bubble around us in the astral, and we go, all right, I'm only going to attract the highest vibrational entities which are in it for my good as well, and are going to, you know, it's a self-fulfilling thing. It's like we believe it's true, so it becomes true to a degree. But if they are autonomous entities, what's really stopping a more powerful, maybe malevolent or maybe not, but like just a more powerful autonomous entity going, there's an interesting little morsel human down there, and it's got a little bubble of self-fulfilling protection around it, but I'll just assume this guy's and go in and see what's up. We don't really know, do we?
It's hard to tell, especially I know that in Brazil, a part of, there are so many people who go into mediumship.
Yeah.
And that is a part of the culture, is to let other entities in. And it can look very spooky. I mean, I remember watching some of the Brazilians going into mediumship. It didn't look elegant.
Well, that's one of the essential tenets of Santa Daime as well, is that they work a lot with spirits and entities, and cleansing and clearing them, and, you know, healing people from them, and, you know, clearing the astral, I guess, in a way. Like, yeah, brush cutting the astral. And that's something that, you know, mainstream shaman, Western shamanic modality, when it's coming to terms with entities, it's still a sort of a tangential issue. It's really, we talk about healing a lot, but we're not really dealing with the realms we go into as much.
Hey, yeah, no, not say trust anything that has, just because it's multidimensional. Since, I mean, I have seen some possessions or some things in ceremony too that looked like a person being something like possessed, but kind of a lower level life form. And that's why it's, in some ways, it's really good to have experienced shamans. And I know of people where the shamans sucked it out of their head, so to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Then afterwards they stopped drinking, they stopped a whole bunch of addictions they were having before. And that's what they also say, that the vomiting can be used for. If there's certain certain techniques of how to make the vomiting more intentional, that sometimes during vomiting people, so to say, vomit out parasitic entities that could be emotional, can be addiction-wise, can be relational, or it can be sometimes also through the ancestral lines. But I know of a lot of people who feel that in the ceremonies, there is more than vomiting going on when they're vomiting.
We've talked about this before, but we both had, you and I, encounters in the astral where entities have basically inhabited our bodies. And I've had this thing where, and you've had it as well, where they seem to then move out my body and make these mudras with the hands. And that's what really interests me. You're probably the first or second person I've come across that seems to have had this same experience, where it seemed to be not a malevolent entity, but what it was actually doing was moving my hands in a way that was making these sort of Vedic mudras, and it seemed to have a very specific purpose. What's your thoughts on that?
I started getting to know those when I was 18, I think, with some of my very first mushrooms experiences, and now it does feel like with certain subcategories of entities that I have almost like a personal relationship where I can let them in my body. And they go into mudra work. And I've seen other people who do that too. I mean, you and some other people who it's really interesting. The amount of precision that kind of is going on, and it feels really like a much more intelligent force who knows how to heal my body, how to rearrange my energy, how to open channels for a deeper experience. And when those mudras happen or when these movements happen, I can really feel the energetic shifts in my system in a really positive way. So that there is lower level entities, but there are also higher level intelligences that it feels like when embodied, and it takes also knowing that you can embody them and knowing that you can give them your body a little bit, can do amazing healing.
I remember I didn't consciously give this entity permission. It just fully came in. But it didn't feel bad per se. But the thing which was really intriguing, there was something to it, was the shape it was making with my hands over and over. As you said, it was like this engine of creation. It was round and round and round. But it made me realize that the human body is like a circuit. And when it came through, it was doing something. And then it made me realize, there's an agenda. But it's like, I wonder what happened in ancient history with mudras and where they originally came from and what the connection historically or culturally is, because it seems to be that our bodies can create these shapes of energy or energetic circuits that the higher entities are working with.
And in some ways that is almost, if you tap really deep into your nervous system, the codes are there. And probably the yogis were just the people who tapped that deep in to get the codes and get the mudras. And plus, I mean, they were on whatever they were playing with, because there are many theories about what soma is. I heard that a lot of the yogic practices were developed in Ma Huang, which gave them the concentration to stare at their belly buttons for hours and hours and hours and hours. Or also, I know that in different traditions they had different sacraments, but I do believe that some of those codes are in our DNA. And then when they get unlocked, our body has ability to heal, ability to work with energy and to create energy and play with energy forms that are very underutilized.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about shamans. What's your experience? I mean, you know, in general terms, I guess the ayahuasca scene is really getting very public now. Every week that seems to go by, we're now in the first week of May 2014 here. I can't remember the amount of Western media. It's been Elle magazine, Marie Claire magazine, Vice. You know, there's pros and cons either way. But what was the latest one I see? Oh, Lindsay Lohan was done ayahuasca, and it's been all over American mainstream media in the last week or two, her experiences. And the last one I saw just yesterday around on the nets, one of the Days of Our Lives main soap stars did ayahuasca and has quit Days of Our Lives because of it.
Uh-huh.
Wow. It's getting so surreal. And so, you know, it's really peaking. And so
some really, really rich and influential people doing ayahuasca and suddenly opening all kinds of charity programs and so on.
Well,
so
it's good. I mean, what it does, it's not ayahuasca as we know, but it's changing people, the experiences, and the people who are then changed go on to change their lives and have the reverberations in the culture. And, you know, one of the overarching metaphors, I guess, I've helped propagate, and it's been around before me, but ayahuasca's a vegetal intelligence. She's working for the planet herself and to get humans back into right relationship. And she's seeding this sort of divine invasion over generations, over long periods of time in a sort of cosmic way. And you see it now peaking so pronouncedly in the mainstream when main actors and things like that are, you know, announcing their ayahuasca experiences and then promulgating the knowledge of ayahuasca even deeper into the mainstream circles. Having said all that, we've got this supply and demand around ayahuasca where millions of mainstream Westerners are really becoming aware of it. And I guess this, in some ways, the safest or the most direct route where it's legal is to go down to South America. And there's this whole ayahuasca tourism scene. Now, we discussed, you know, your background as a psychotherapist, a life coach, and your own altered states experiences and relationship with ayahuasca. How do you feel now then going into that dynamic of, I guess, ayahuasca tourism is one phrase for it. And what's your context for it?
It does depend who you're working with, yes. And there are so many different kinds of shamans. And I know that I have worked with clients where the main issue they brought to me as a therapist was being, how would I say, sexually engaged by a shaman in inappropriate ways or in ways that opened them up at the time but then had really negative consequences and led to trauma. So I know that one of the harder things also with the shamans in Peru is often that they come from a Peruvian culture, and a lot of breaches have been around sexuality with Western women, whether it was consensual or not, or by using the altered state or the power dynamics, so that's a boundary to be really careful about. I heard some horror stories when I was in Peru too about people who go into the jungle, get handled ayahuasca, drink, and then the shaman goes, "Thank you very much, bye now," and lets them deal with it super high in the jungle. Or the last time I was there, somebody was telling me about other shamans who almost intentionally overdose tourists. And tell them, and when the tourists start going into the death experience, they're going, "I know what's making you die. I know what's making you die. It's your ring. It's your pendant. Give them to me. Give them to me. Then you can not die." And wow. Pretty much collecting everybody's jewelry. So it is a tricky one, that in one hand, it's such a deep, powerful tool. And on the other hand, it's in the hands of a really poor culture, which is on one hand needing the money, on the other hand still having very different understandings around sexuality and boundaries. So that's why it's been huge for me to work to find and continue finding and interviewing the right people who are, A, can hold the right space in the ceremony, but B, also can hold the right space around contracts, agreements, and everything that comes on beforehand. As somebody who organizes a retreat, because they have to be businessmen enough to know how to handle themselves, show up in time, not change the contract last moment, and so on, and how to find the sweet spot of between the two. But I have heard a lot of horror stories as witch shamans, so to say, abusing their power. And one of the people I'm talking to in Peru is Dr. Andrew McLean Pagan. And I know that he's a psychiatrist in Peru, and that he is one of the people who is going to be pushing for new regulations around shamanism and around what it will take to be a shaman, so that, so to say, brujeria can be minimized. I really hope that he doesn't make the regulations so that some of the really deep indigenous shamans who do come from a good place don't get to practice. I'm really curious where that's going to end. But I know that for some of them, they're like children. They can be amazing shamans, but in some ways, they're like children. And when it comes to money or to sex, just because somebody can work the astral amazingly doesn't mean they have the ethics down. or other parts of their personality are very developed. So I have learned how to be more and more discerning about who I work with.
So, you know, you've hit on some really cool points there, and it is a different culture in South America, and, you know, I've only been to Peru per se with the shaman sort of circuit there. But, you know, it's a very machismo culture, as you say, and regardless, you know, taking shamanism out of the equation, it's a culture which really does have a certain attitude towards women and the energy they bring there, you know, as male shamans into a ceremony. And then with Westerners and the money dynamic and the power dynamic, I find this so interesting as well, because, you know, I guess some of the key things and terms I'm taking from your work as a psychotherapist is this idea about relationships as well, you know, and how we manage our relationships. And so what we're seeing here on a cultural level is, you know, how does the culture of West and all its inbuilt dogmas and inbuilt neuroses and things go down to another culture which has its own inbuilt neuroses and dogmas, and there's this clash on a cultural level. And then individually, you know, when the cultural imprints manifest in an individual, how do we find that right shaman that might come from this background of a machismo culture and all this other stuff, and the money thing, but then find that right person which resonates with our needs at the time. It's difficult.
Right. And it also takes testing and trying. And I mean, I had learned from some of my previous retreats to make almost contracts with the shamans to not have, to not go into any kind of affairs with the participants, even if it is after the ceremony, even if the whole thing is finished and the whole retreat is over. So you have to clear grace periods. There were some experiences that were not so positive in the past that I learned that even if there is engagement after the retreat and after the ceremony, it can be to some kind of a murky waters.
Well, that's the whole therapist-patient sort of issue, isn't it? Even the West has that safety net there.
Yeah, it is actually similar, and it can also be like somebody you put in a pedestal as a healer who then, if you go into a personal relationship, can do some, and if there is any kind of cultural or otherwise kind of disagreements in that personal relationship that can change your, the attitude to the healing you received in the past. So I have learned to be very strict around certain boundaries with the shamans I work with, as well as on the other hand, they come from a culture where I remember one of the shamans I worked with saying, "You guys are so lucky that you want to work on things like world peace and opening to your higher self and big forgiveness," because the way it was traditionally used, they were using it to kill that other guy who has more chickens, or to make sick that other neighbor from the other tribe who looked at their wife a certain way. So it's almost, they come from a culture where the intentions between using, behind using ayahuasca have been very much against each other for this kind of a petty wars. So that was very interesting to hear, that in a way the Westerners are also bringing a higher vibration of working with the medicine than some of it, the way it's been traditionally used. Yeah. Although, of course, I mean, the traditional users are many, and I don't want to minimize that to that.
How have you found your personal experience? You touched on it a bit there, but how have the shamans reacted to you as a woman? And, you know, I find you're quite a powerful woman. You're very assertive, you know, and you're very strong, and I think a lot of times shamans can be threatened by that in a man, much less in a woman, as well as the cultural, you know, differences around women. How have you found you've been received as a woman in you know, in South America?
The culture, I had to definitely learn to step up and be much more clear. It's been the only one experience ever that I have felt like my gender made a difference. And that I had to put extra strength behind my words and extra oomph behind my agreements and put my foot down even stronger just because I'm a woman who's often younger than them. So that's been the only context where there was some of this machismo Latino culture I had to encounter and deal with. And on the other hand, I've learned to encounter and deal with. And in some ways, by bringing in more of my masculine and much more of my being very clear with contracts, being able to stand your ground in a very strong way, because there is almost sometimes, and I don't want to generalize, but I have had the feeling in some ways where it's been harder to be taken seriously by being a woman who is not their age, too. I mean, there is been between the fact that I'm more on the younger side and that I'm a woman compared to most of the shamans that I had to almost prove myself extra. Yes.
But you're not meeting them on the same shamanic level. You're not claiming to be a shamanic practitioner. As you say, you're a psychotherapist that does the before and the after, and a businesswoman, I guess, moving into this modality. Is there a threat there to them still?
Yes. At least in one of the retreats I did, there was still a little bit of a power struggle. Yes, yeah, about who's the boss and who's in control and so on. So we had to do some negotiation.
Yeah.
Because there is something about it, it's still about me being in charge about the big part of the experience that can be apparently still a threat to a male from a Latino culture that has a hard time negotiating with a woman as an equal. So, but I have learned to step up and how to hold my ground. So I feel comfortable doing that now. But it was a little bit of a learning curve.
Good. And I guess, you know, it is a learning curve because, well, you've been working around Peru and around the Iquitos region, haven't you? And that's sort of, you know, the core geographic location for the shamanic sort of revival of the West. There's dozens and dozens of lodges. And, you know, since I first went to Peru in 2006, it's probably trebled in the amount of practitioners and lodges and shamans and Westerners backing those lodges. How do you find the scene there, and how do you find your place, I guess, in the type of tour groups you're taking down there, and how do you find that the context of the scene in around the Kitos?
It was interesting. I got some experience, and also partially with going to the 9th Amazonian Conference. They brought a whole bunch of shamans who had to introduce themselves. It was like almost everybody had to show their things, their song, and how they work. So it was a little bit like a, I wouldn't call it a shaman fashion show, but something like that, where A, you got to drink with a whole lot of people, and also you got a sense of their personality and their work and what kind of space they hold. So it was interesting to, and they were all people who were pretty approved and by the people from the conference. And I know there are many other people around who are very grassroots. So I cannot speak from a huge experience, but I have had the opportunity to drink with multiple ones of them. And or also hear from other participants of the conference about what it was like to drinking with other ones, and how there was from people who held amazing space, like with the woman Adela I worked with, I did the December retreat with. I was pretty impressed by her work, and she's working with her son Jose. On the other hand, I heard from one of the other shamans who was letting people bang their heads against the wall, and there was other Westerners who had to make sure they don't break something. So that was like also like hearing people who don't hold a good space at all and just go for the strong brew. So I have heard everything from and experienced the whole palette of different things. But that's where it comes to kind of having experiences with different people to fine-tune what is it, what I'm looking for, how do they hold space when it gets difficult, and how do they resource people, how do they bring out the medicine, what kind of medicine they have. It's a testing process.
So tell us then a bit about some of the retreats that you've been holding down, and how many have you held, and who have you worked with?
I held one in December with Adela and Jose, and I held another one in February with Raul, and I'm planning to hold another one in July after the conference with in a center close to Iquitos with Ricardo Amaringo, and there will be another one in December with a really special shaman from Therapalto too.
Great. And how do you find, I mean, this one, I guess what I'm getting at is the shamanic scene is getting so dense and so there's so many people working in it. How do you find the right people to work with?
It's still a try and error, because it's partially to going to Peru and drinking with them myself. And it's still a different experience because with some people I can be extremely impressed with what they like as a shaman, but then have a hard time with them as a business person or making agreements and sticking to agreements. Or with other people, let's say 4 months later, they're in a different space than the space I drank with them with. But and some of them it's been by recommendation. Like, I know a lot of people are raving about Ricardo Amaringo. And his approach to work and his center, and there are some of them are people I trust really deeply. But it is a trial and error, and with some of the people I worked with, I will work again. With some of them, I'm more hesitant. So it depends. It still feels like I do hope to find one shaman that I feel completely confident about working with and continue to work with. But I also do like the stage I'm in right now, in which I'm working with different people and learning more and more about what I want, what I'm looking for, what I'm not okay with putting up with. And it's kind of almost like the dating process before you get married.
Yeah, I think it's important what you say as well, is that not just their reputations, but I guess their energies change as well. So you may work with a shaman, you know, 6 months ago, and it might have been fine, but in the interim maybe they've done, you know, 6 months of Western tourists and they're getting over Western tourists, but they've also got a lot of money from that, or reputations change very quickly as well. It's hard to keep track of everything. I guess you've got to be on the ground to do that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you've got some retreats coming up in July, you said, and then in December?
In July and in December.
And what's your website, and how can people connect with you and what you're doing?
My website is marianadinkova.com, which has a little bit of a funky spelling. So it's M like a Mary, E like England, R like Robert, I like India, A like Anna, N like Nancy, A like Anna, D like Dorothy, I like India, N like Nancy, K like Kevin, O like Oliver, B like Victory, A like Anna. And I hope you will have a way to put a link with the
I'll
website.
I'll put a link here at the bottom of the audio.
I know. Name is a little bit hard to spell, so.
And that list as well, you know, you've got your Western. So I think one of the most interesting things I find about you is that you are integrating this into your, you know, legal Western psychotherapy modality and helping people, you know, navigate these altered states and have training and have that support network for pre-flight sort of training and then post-flight integration. And I think that's really, really valuable as well.
And people get a lot out of the integration part too. I mean, yay for the tools and yay for the emotional content and family content and different topics we do at the beginning, but people get a lot out of having enough time for integration at the end. Yeah. And with some of them are my clients, some of them become my clients, or we do some extra integration sessions. So it's also beautiful to be able to, months later, use some of the knowledge that happened during the retreats or some of the experience that were experienced. And that's the other thing that often in the West, in the Western or even in the more traditional ayahuasca sessions, you leave in the morning. That's your integration. It's like maybe a quick sharing, a cup of tea, and you go.
It's true, yeah. The sharing circle, you know, is great, but it's not that deep, really. People usually just tell you about their visions and things. It's nice, but it's not, you know, perhaps as integrative as it could be.
And that's why also, I mean, I sometimes get people reaching out to me from the web who have found that I'm a psychotherapist who also has a lot of knowledge about working with ayahuasca and have become some of my Skype clients. And I love, actually, people who... That's their motivation, is how to integrate some of those experiences. And some of them have reached out to me with having these really negative experiences where the shaman completely invalidated them and they were feeling, so to say, they had a lot of hard feelings to deal with and then we have to patch it up together. Or some of them had amazing experiences and are finding ways to integrate it in their life. But there are some of my favorite clients. People who have done medicine work or want to do medicine work and want to get prepared and want to have those insights and those depths of experience influence their normal everyday life to a deeper degree than just go have an experience or have a retreat, come back and be the same.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm really excited about doing that work with people.
Beautiful. All right. Mariana, thank you so much for your time. It's been really wonderful to talk with you about all these inner shamanic sort of potentials within. And best of luck with everything.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rick. Have a beautiful day.
Aloha.